Okay, I was gonna say, you had mine, you want to.
Thank you.
You sound like you had a reason for wanting it.
I may. It's always nice to be able to come home and say, I got this swag, but my daughter's gonna want this, I'm not giving this away.
Right. See, I was gonna give mine to my boss, but I don't know if he'll get the joke or not. That's why I wanna give him the hat, because he kind of overpowered it.
I got a hat.
You could always offer.
Hmm?
I got a hat. Didn't you all get a hat and a bag?
Mm-hmm. I did. That's what I'm saying. I'm gonna give it to my boss when I get home, see if he gets the joke.
These are my kids, by the way, if you hadn't figured it out already, why there's two little monkeys on the screen. Usually I've got a little slideshow going with a bunch of pictures, but my wife sent me this picture yesterday, and
new
it's
pictures.
My kids, so you know, it's my kid.
You're not a family man at all, right?
Doesn't seem that way, does it? There we go. Hey, look at that, it works.
Does your mic, are you talking in Dan's room now?
I hope not. No, they said that each one of the mics had its own receiver, so he took the mic and the receiver over there.
Oh, okay.
Plugged it into the board over there until they're all set.
I was thinking I probably shouldn't have said anything. That would have been interesting for the first few minutes.
It would have. It would have. They might have more interesting things to say than I do for, you know, I don't know.
No, I just meant the crosstalk, you know, because they'd be looking at Dan hearing you, and we'd be looking at you hearing Dan, so that would be, you know, weird.
Or then people would just say, oh, it's 8:30 in the morning, I'm hearing voices,
right.
And we get
right.
Another cup of coffee. Hi, everyone. My name is Paul Cavallis, Progress with Consulting out of Montreal. Been doing this for, God, 20 years now. In 20 years, I'm a little junior in the room always. I've talked to the Toms and the Dans, and they're 20 years off. They had already built their fourth enterprise application by 1994. And, oh, come on, no, I'm a young guy in here, so. But 20 years, I might know a little bit something that I'm talking about, so. So we're gonna talk about sharing static data with Amazon S3. Who is using Amazon anything now? Amazon, that's great.
We're trying, but we're not quite there
cool.
Yet.
So EC2, S3, who's using S3 already? A couple of people, cool. What about like CloudFront, the Postgres databases, anything else like that? Okay, cool, so everyone's, that's all right, cool. So I'll just go quickly into what all this Amazon stuff is for everybody else. And we'll talk a little bit about Amazon S3 and why you're almost insane not to use it today. I mean, for any kind of file sharing that you need to do with your customers. It's always weird when she walks in and starts digging. I'm supposed to ignore her, I know, but you can't. Just comes in. She's going to come stand right here now. I'm supposed to ignore her. See, look, she's coming. See, I told you.
Sorry, we have no makeup today.
Sorry, I only had one cup of coffee this morning.
I knew she'd show up because I'm wearing this orange shirt.
That's right.
Excuse me.
This is my natural pose.
Yeah. <All right.
coughs> So what is Amazon? Thank you, and I'm sorry for calling attention to you.
Sorry for not ignoring you, man.
Yes. I don't think she was very impressed with my humor. That's also been the story of my life. So.
Maybe she hasn't had her second cup of coffee either.
Sometimes I wonder why my wife married me. I'm like, are you sure you married me? Are you sure? So Amazon currently provides 29 insane infrastructure services for pennies on the dollar. You can do so much. It's insane. I have not used half of them because, God, I don't know, you could probably spend your entire life just trying to use all these Amazon services. But I basically tell people today, if there's something you want to do and you have to buy hardware in your office to do it, see if you can do it on Amazon first for cheap, at least for your proof of concept. I bet you can do it for 14 cents on Amazon, you know, rather than spending $7,000 on a server to do it at home. We did, in February, we did the VA Day at the Toronto User Group. So it was me, Tom Bascom, Rich Banville, and Dan Foreman in Toronto doing a DBA thing. And one of the things we did, me and Tom did a head-to-head dump and load competition. You know? So, of course, neither of us has like super fast disk I.O. machines sitting at home. There's no EMC SAN in my basement, sorry. So we just fired up a couple of machines on Amazon. We put very high dedicated disk IO VMs. They ended up costing us, if I remember correctly, the two VMs ended up costing us $15 a day to run, of which $1 a day was basically the machine, and $14 a day was the dedicated disk IO. So if you don't really need super crazy disk IO, you're running these machines for a buck or two a day, basically. So we did all of our benchmark dump and load tests with these machines. Cost pennies on the dollar. We didn't have to go spend thousands of dollars for machines, and we were running crazy fast machines, 8 CPU, I don't know, 16, 32 gigs of RAM, and 1500 IO ops, which is roughly 10 dedicated disks, 20 if you say RAID 10. So that's a lot of machine for 15 bucks a day, so pretty good. So EC2 is the whole deployment in the cloud thing. So everybody's been screaming at you guys that you should deploy your stuff in the cloud, and why aren't you in the cloud, and why aren't you running your application in the cloud? That's EC2. So fire up a Windows server or a Linux server in the cloud. Get started with that. If anybody has never, ever, ever done this before, on my website there's a presentation called Getting Started in the Cloud. It'll really walk you through step by step by step in super easy detail on how to launch your first Linux instance in the Amazon cloud. So you can just download that from my website if you want to get started with Amazon EC2. But today we're really going to talk about S3. And S3, I'd rather call it S4 because it's simple storage service somewhere. You don't really know where your stuff is being stored. Your choices are, well, US standard, which is somewhere out on the East Coast, or the West Coast, or Singapore, or Sao Paulo, Brazil. So it's just disk space. I should say file system space, because you don't get raw disks, you get file system space. Somewhere, anywhere, you pick where it is. Excuse me. But you've got a few bells and whistles that you can do with it. There's a little bit of extra toys that come with just the plain old file system space. And the other thing that's cool is that all this file system space is available to you through a simple URL, HTTP. This is a real URL. There's this bottle of Talisker 18 years, and there's a JPEG of it in my Amazon S3 at that URL. And that's how you access that that image. So if I wanted to share it, I could take this URL, and if you try it, it won't work because it's locked down, but if I made it public, you could all go and download this beautiful picture of Talisker. Sorry, you cannot download the bottle of Talisker. Are there any Scotch drinkers here who are appreciating a Talisker 18 year? Okay. I would have seen more smiles.
I'm a Glen Moranger guy.
Wow. That's good. So very easy to access the files. Yeah.
Have you been talking about the pricing?
Absolutely.
The
Talisker. I can tell. No, this is a Talisker 18. It is not $60. And I'll tell you, the Talisker is a lot more expensive than the Amazon S3. So.
Worth more too.
Exactly. Excuse me. So yeah, we're talking about file system space, a few bells and whistles. We're talking about how you can use all this stuff. I didn't mention it earlier, but if you have questions, please don't hesitate. As you've noticed, it's a pretty light-hearted presentation, so I don't mind. Just raise your hand and interject if you have any questions. So you can share these files through those HTTP URLs with anyone. You can share them with a private group of people who have an access key. You can open them up wide open to the public. But what the coolest part about Amazon S3 is you can do somewhere in between in the way you share your files. And I've done a couple of really cool projects with customers for exactly that. How do I share files with the public in a controlled manner, but I don't want to host 100 gigs of files on my disk servers and then have to pay for all that up and down IO through my corporate network. Let me just throw it up there and then really figure out how am I going to share this with my customer base. So a very, very cool project I'll tell you guys about after I go through a few more slides about Amazon S3 here. So how do you get started? So today, how many of you said you already have an Amazon account? So about half the room has the Amazon account. So the very first thing, just go to aws.amazon.com. You absolutely need a credit card. Everything's charged monthly to your credit card. And for the first stuff, a whole bunch of the things are free. So Amazon EC2, for example, there's a free tier, and you can get a whole bunch of stuff for free. Yeah.
Is the Amazon account for this the same? If you're shop with Amazon,
yes,
is it the same
yes.
entity?
So the question is, if you shop with Amazon, is it the same entity? The answer is yes. So I sign in, when I buy stuff from Amazon.ca, Amazon.com, and AWS.Amazon.com, all three, for me, those three entities all use the same account, the same credit card number. So whether I buy stuff from Amazon, it'll the credit card number, the shipping information is there. Same thing for Amazon and AWS.
Can you mix and determine, like, okay, I'm doing some stuff for business, so I put the business stuff charged to the business credit card. I'm doing some stuff personal, and I can charge it to my personal credit card.
Yeah, so the question is, can I mix and match credit cards and decide what goes billed where? Absolutely yes, or you can open up two accounts, but definitely you can store multiple credit cards in your account and say, please charge this credit card for these services. So, excuse me. Or, you know, you can charge all your personal stuff to the business credit card and tell your boss that it's Amazon AWS stuff, you know? Like the bottle of Talisker, it was part of the lab. So a lot of this stuff is free in the first year. So don't be hesitant to try. Also, if you look around the web or if you go to different shows, they had them here last year, there's often, Amazon gives away these promo cards. They give them away like candy. So if you scope around the web, you'll find them, and they're $50 credit, $100 credit, whatever. So you just put in the promo code in your Amazon account, and bang, you've got $50 more. So you get your first year free, and then you got another $50-$100 to just play with. So if you just troll around the internet a little bit, it shouldn't be hard to find these promo cards to get another $50 or $100 worth of services for free. And for me, $100 of services, other than the lab where we were chewing through $15 a day, that could be like 6 months of Amazon stuff for me. The other fun thing is when you set up your Amazon account, especially at the beginning when you're not too sure what you're doing, you can set up billing alarms. So you can say, when I hit $10, send me an alarm. Which is very useful, because if you hit the $10 alarm on the first day of the month, you probably want to know that you configured something that you need to stop really quickly. So set up those alarms just in case, so you don't end up at the end of the month with a surprise of $300 because you didn't realize that you provisioned some crazy machine or some crazy disk space that's costing you $10-$20 a day. So watch out for that. But it's very hard to do, I'll admit. I mean, you'd have to really trip over your feet for you to do that. So I always like when people leave. I do it all the time. So we opened up our account. We've got a bunch of free stuff that we know about. That's great. So what do I need to do? So typically the first thing you're going to do, regardless of which Amazon service you're going to use, is you're going to set up users and groups. So the way Amazon works, you can set up security on the object itself, or you can set up security on the person. Either or, it's the same JSON file to structure the security, but you can apply it to a user or a group. It's probably easier to apply security to the user than it is to apply security to a specific object. So you'll say, here is my user that I'm creating. So I created pqphallus, I created pub read only, and I created pub read write. And so I said, it's very easy. Pqphallus will get administrative rights and be able to do everything. Pub read only will get read only rights across the board. So not only across Amazon S3, but if read-only rights, if you will, pertain to some other services like CloudFront or whatever, I can use PugRO, and then PugReadWrite gives read and write access to all of my services, but you'll see in a second, they don't have administrative rights, for example, to give read and write access to other users. And again, pretty easy to do. I usually do it with groups, so I'll create the users, but I'll assign the security to the groups. So I'll have an admin group, a read-only group, and a read-write group, and now I'll assign all the security to the groups. And Amazon makes it easy. So it's a JSON file. There is, I don't know, about 50 or so different, call them like actions that you can secure. But if you go into the little wizard here, he says, oh, do you want an administrative user, a power user, a read-only user? Or they have a little policy generator, so you can actually go in and either type this stuff by hand, or and it'll at least format it properly, so you're not doing the JSON formatting by yourself with all the braces and the whatnots. So you can do that through the policy generator, or you can use the sample templates. So in my case, it's just easier to use the sample templates, because in reality, these are the three groups you're going to probably deploy. You have your read-write groups, your read-only groups, and your administrative groups. The only thing, like I said, maybe with the power user or the read-write groups, maybe you only want to give them read-write to all the Amazon S3 stuff. So you can actually take the JSON file that's going to have the 50 or 60 actions in there, and then just delete the stuff that you don't want. It's probably easier to do that. Only leave S3 this, S3 that, S3 this, S3 that in the file, and then your read-write group will only have S3. Frank,
yeah? Yeah, this is particular to S3. This is not an EC2.
So the question is this particular to S3 and not to EC2? It's actually global, so there are where... So it depends where it makes sense that you're applying these security rules. So in EC2, in reality, there's going to be administrative roles here that will allow you or not allow you to launch instances, for example. But the actual instance when you try to log in as root or as EC2 user into the instance, that's not managed by here. Is that your question? Did I answer that?
Yeah.
Okay. But you can control, because you could be in an instance and launch another instance. And you can script all your launching of your Linux boxes and your Windows boxes. So you can say, hey, this user is allowed to launch new instances, but I don't want to let a guy into my system. And, you know, he's working on my system and he decides to launch himself a 8 CPU, a 32 gig machine for $1 an hour, and I don't even know about it. So he won't have those access rights.
The users that you're making here, are these like the usernames themselves you made up?
Yeah.
Those are those private to your setup? So like if four of us in the room, could we all have made PugChallenge RO, PugChallenge RW? Each of us have our own PugChallenge RO, RW.
So the question is, are these usernames that I'm showing you here, are they global usernames or are they my account usernames? In reality, they're neither. They're really just descriptive placeholders. Because what ends up happening is that, do I show? I don't show it. What ends up happening is, in reality, for each user, there's a secret access key, which is this, you know, a long, bizarre number that's generated, there's an access key ID and a secret access code, which is an even longer string of numbers. And those are the username passwords you use for the various services. So it's called PugRW, but really when I want to use the PugRW account, I'm using the access key and the secret access code in my, whether it's an Amazon S3 or whatever other service that I'm using, that would where these policies would apply. And the way Amazon works too, is when you create these users and these roles and you say, hey, okay, generate those keys for me, please. He's gonna generate those keys. You have one chance to download the password. That's it. You download the password into a CSV file. The minute you download the password and you click OK, you can never see, Amazon will never give you that password again. In fact, Amazon probably doesn't know what that password is because it only keeps the hashed value somewhere. So you have to, you know, figure out how you're going to store those access, secret access codes, those passwords yourself, if you're going to use them afterwards. But once you download, you generate and download the secret access code, that's it. You'll never see it again from Amazon, right? It's a bit like Google also has the same thing, where if you need to have a third party sign into Google, then Google will create for you a temporary password, which you can use to sign in using the third party app. And then that password is one use only. It can never be used again from somebody else to sign into the into your Google account. So it's a little bit the same idea. So now we've got our users. And again, those were just really descriptive text that we're putting on their user's name. What I don't show you here that I just talked about is I'm actually generating a secret access key, an access key and a secret code. I assign roles to these users to say what are they allowed to do, and then depending on how much time we have at the end, we'll go in and look in Amazon. I don't like to do demos because they never work, so I never plan for a demo, but at the end, if there's time, I'll show you. But if it doesn't work, then I don't say that my demo didn't work. Like poor Shelly. Was anybody at Shelly's talk yesterday? Yeah, where her demo didn't quite go as planned. Poor Shelly. So this is a little bit what the what's generated. So here is, for example, my read-write group. So you can see in my statement, I'm doing an allow, not a deny. And I want to say basically everything, but not anything that's generated with that's related to identity and access management. So if you've got the secret access key and password for this RW group, for a user in the RW group, you can do pretty much anything in my account, but you can't create new users or modify permissions or do any of that stuff. All right? And you can see it's pretty simple. If you looked at the read-only group, each one of the roles is listed one after the other and gives you you can do this read-only, this action, and it lists all the read-only actions like, list bucket or list objects, for example, which we'll talk about here in S3. So I've got my users now, I'm set up, I'm ready to go. I can now actually create disk space in Amazon S3 file system space. And Amazon S3 calls these things buckets. I don't know why it's buckets, that's what they call it. So you can think of it as when you create a directory or a file system or a share or however you want to think about it in the Amazon S3 space, it's actually called a bucket. And it's shared like this, bucket.s3.amazonaws.com. And you must follow DNS naming rules. So, for example, you can't put mix uppercase and lowercase. If you mix uppercase and lowercase in your bucket name, then you're really going to have to access it as s3.amazonaws.com/bucket because DNS naming rules, they map everything to lowercase anyways. So even if you put bucket capital B, U, C, capital K, the DNS will look it up all in lowercase. So you cannot use... If you want to use this format, then you have to follow the DNS compliant naming rules, all right, for all your bucket names. Or again, you can just do s3.amazon.com/bucket. So now I've got a bucket. It's not a disk space. It's your S3 space of your account is your entire account. I'm just segregating chunks, and again, think of them as file systems or shares or directories. But it's really now, it's a logical thing. So I want to put patch downloads in patch. I want to put images in images. I want to put, something else reports in reports. And then you share the various buckets with various people. All right. There's a tool out there called CloudBerry Explorer. Anybody using CloudBerry Explorer? Ever heard of it? So very cool free tool. It's basically Windows Explorer. You can see the look and feel. It's free, but for Amazon S3. So if you already have Amazon S3 account, you can go here. You'll create your account. So I went in. I called it PK. I put in the secret access key and the access code for my read-write user, for example. And then, bang, once I connected to S3, here's my three buckets that I created in Amazon. So very cool, very free, and of course every time you do something that's a little bit not allowed, they'll say, oh, you can do that in the pro version, $29.99 or whatever the price is. So it's a freemium application. You can do a lot of stuff for free, but the advanced features, you have to buy the pro version. But it's still a very cool way if you want to, for example, map a network drive, that's directly on your Amazon S3, then you can do your backups you see in your normal Windows Explorer that it's just a normal drive, but it's actually somewhere out there in the Amazon cloud. All that for, whatever it is, $50 or something like that for the premium version. So definitely worth the money, but at the very least, download the free version so you can do this stuff and just transfer stuff back and forth. And you can do a lot of the bucket policy stuff. You can see a lot of it from here. I think modifying most of the bucket policies and all that requires the premium version, but you can still do quite a bit with the free version. And again, very cool tool for just testing, or if you just want to upload files to source, you know, to seed your stuff, you'll probably do it from here rather than using some of the command line tools or whatever, or maybe instead of using the Amazon web interface to upload files, you can just drag and drop files from here very easily.
Is it fairly fast?
Yeah, it's as fast as uploading it to the web. I mean, it's as fast as your internet connection, basically.
All right.
And
I've been using SCP this entire time.
Yeah. Well, it works fine. I mean,
you got to have the key, you know, explicitly know where it is, and it's a pain, you know, because the command line's about that long.
Yes.
Because of the name of the EC2 volume is.
Oh, you're copying up to your EC2 volume.
Right.
Oh, I see. But this is not an EC2 volume, right? This is just S3. There's no EC2 at all here. There's no machine. There is no Linux box or Windows box associated here.
Oh, so you've just got, okay.
It's fine. Just disk space. That's it. It's just an amount of space somewhere on the cloud.
Okay, so we're using the EC3, you know, connected to our instance.
What you're saying is you have a Linux box in the cloud.
Yeah, we have a Linux instance up there, and I'm copying stuff up to it. And it's using S3, so I could use this, right?
Yes, but you have two things now. You're paying for the Linux instance, and you're paying for the disk space. So you're paying for both now. So you're paying for a 1 CPU, 4 CPU, 8 CPU, and you're paying for X gigs of disk space.
Right.
Whereas here, I don't need the Linux box. I don't need the Linux box. I just need disk space. So I'm not paying for any disk space. For any box. I'm paying for disk space. That's it. Now, mind you, there's no question here of disk speed. You can't buy S3 with IOPS. You know, like you're doing database accesses, because that's not the intended purpose. Whereas with EC2, you can specify how much IOPS you want to pay for, if you want faster disks or SSDs.
Right, but my point was, is since we're using the S3 on this EC2 image, I can still use this tool to move it up there, right?
Yeah, so if your EC2 image is talking to an S3 volume, well, it's just an S3 volume like any other S3 volume. So you can push it up directly, and I'll show you exactly how to do it in the next few slides. Frank, question?
Yeah, you know, with my EC2 instance, I have volumes, right?
Yes. So, but they're not S3 volumes, they're EBS volumes.
Right.
Okay.
So those are not accessible to here. So sorry, I don't want to get into S3, EBS, and all these other volume types, but it's a different volume type on Amazon than EBS volume.
So instead of that volume, could I use S3?
So the question is, if I have an EC2 volume, can I just create an EC2 machine? Can I just take an S3 volume and map it? I want to say no, not directly, but there must be a way, and I've never done it. But when you're actually configuring the machine, and most of the times when you're requesting disk space, there's this notion of disk IOPS, you know, what kind of disks do you want? I don't think you can do it. I think what you need to do is create it as an S3 bucket.
Should I look at this as something similar to Dropbox?
Yes, you should look at it as something similar to Dropbox. But I'm pretty sure you can probably NFS mount this S3 volume on your EC2 volume using some tools. And I don't know what the tools are, I'm sorry, because it's not really intended for that use, but there must be a way to mount it as an NFS volume. I don't think you can mount your S3 volume as a native slash dev slash, and Roy is shaking his head, so.
Actually, there is, I don't know any of this, I'm just Googling it.
So, okay.
But there is a S3FS file system that you can attach to your EC2 volume.
Well, there you go, learn something new every day. So you can, but I bet you it's an S3FS file system. I wouldn't be surprised though if behind it is some kind of NFS that's occurring. So there you go, S3FS volumes. I've never tried it because in my head, that's not the purpose, it's not the use of S3, but thanks to Tom.
It's not the preferred way of doing it, but it's possible.
It's definitely possible.
Guys, how does speed compare? Volume versus
think of the difference of doing direct writes to a disk versus copying something up to the...
To an NFS card.
It's not comparable. If you wanted to run a database this way, I would say, you get what you paid for.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I have to think when you...
So when you mount
your EC2 volume and you're using disk, you know, actual disk space, depending on the size of the machine you get, like, so if you get a 4 CPU 16 gig machine which costs, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 cents a minute, it comes with SSD drives or SSD drive equivalents. So you're getting, I don't want to say free, but included is, you know, 500 gigs of SSD drives, so you're not going to attach S3FS for your whatever. The only reason I could see doing it is if you're using S3 for some kind of file sharing for its real intended use, but your Amazon EC2 instance is supplying files or feeding files into that S3 to share, you know, in the normal S3 way. So there I would see a good reason to try to mount your S3. But the reality is I have done exactly this, but we use the S3 tools that we'll talk about in a second. So I did a project with PHP, so I used the PHP SDK to talk to S3 from my Amazon instance in the traditional manner, rather than trying to do an S3FS mount to mount volumes across, to mount it as a regular volume.
It's not an Amazon product, it's a third party.
Ah, okay. So then he's just doing the same thing we're doing, the same thing like CloudBerry. So he's hiding the complexities of the S3 behind his product. So that answers your question that it's not native. It's going through the same API as everybody else to access S3. So. Any questions so far? It's not that complicated. I don't think it's not magical. It's just, I had trouble wrapping around my head all this disk space for a couple of pennies, and we'll see the pricing later. It's
just
pretty
good. It's FTP over HTTP.
Sorry?
Think of it as FTP over HTTP.
Yeah, FTP, SCP. How about SCP? Because it is somewhat secure. SCP over HTTP. So just a quick recap. All of this is going to take you, I say 30 minutes, because I'm assuming you're all IT people and you can't type to save your lives, as I've seen from my various labs. So if you could, it would take your wives or your typing people 10 minutes to do all this. The rest of you are going to type everything wrong. It's going to take you 30 minutes to do all of this. Literally, bang, open the account, create a couple of users, create your buckets, install CloudBerry, upload your files, bang, you're ready to share your file. Very, very easy, very, 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 very dirty to do. All right? So what else? This is where we get into the cool stuff for Amazon S3. So who cares? Who cares about disk space? Okay, yes, it's great. I don't have to store the gigabytes of stuff on my Office file servers. I can just store them in the cloud. But some of the other cool stuff that you can do is really where the value comes. First one, you can have the downloader pay. So you can set it up so that through a different kind, there's different ways to do it, but you can set it up so when people are uploading and downloading files with their access keys, they're paying for that upload. Even if it's only a couple of pennies, they're paying for it and not you. So you can set it up so that the person who's grabbing the stuff is paying for it. You can set up BitTorrent. So if you want to share peer-to-peer BitTorrent illegal movies, knock yourselves out. I don't know that Amazon trolls through the contents of S3 looking for copyrighted or non-copyrighted information, but it certainly supports sharing peer-to-peer directly. Cool stuff like file versioning. So you can tell them to keep, every time you upload a file, keep a version, keep this many versions of the files. So he can do that automatically for you. And another really cool one is static websites. So if you have a website that doesn't require ASP.NET and Joomla and all the databases, and it's just a nice, flat, static website, you can stick it in a bucket and tell the bucket that it's a website. And so now when someone goes to HTTP, bucket dot blah blah blah, or if you redirect the URL there, you have a website. It's just a normal static index.html website. So a very cool way, if you just want to host, excuse me, a silly website on the web, that doesn't change at all. You can just stick it there and it costs you like literally pennies a month to do. And lifecycle management, which is another cool thing. So say you're using S3 to share patches with your customers or share other kind of information, you can say upload it, and in 3 days delete it. It's going to be there for 3 days. You got 3 days. So you don't have to think every time you upload something, I have to remember to go do my cleanup or run up a cleanup batch job or anything like that. You don't have to remember any of that. You can just set it up so that anything that goes on there has a life cycle of a day or two, and then it's gone. So because you don't want to be paying, even if it's only a couple of pennies a month, you don't want to be paying for something up there that's never ever going to be downloaded or used. You patched, you put the patch up, it's good for a couple of days, it gets automatically deleted. Thank you very much. All right. So very, very cool way to do it. And we're using that again. I'll go through my project that I did later on for a customer. And you'll see how all of these technologies came in to really solve the problem that they had. Right. Now, this is the coolest part of Amazon S3, and that's pre-signed URLs. If you go to that talisker.jpg that I showed, you will get an access denied, period. But I want you to be able to download the file. But I don't want to give you a username password and then have to go and then delete the username password after, you know, like, okay, it's good for a day, so here I'll, and then I have to delete the username password, and then you want to download it, so I'll create another username password and delete the password. I don't want to have to deal with that garbage, so I can create a pre-signed URL, which means I can take the username password and an expiry date, create a URL with a key embedded in it, and that URL is good for 24 hours. Well, it's good until the second that I say it's not good anymore. So I can say create a key. I'll talk about it more later, but I say create a key that's good until June 10th, 2014 at 14:07:29 Eastern Time, period. And that key is good until that time. Anyone can download, who has that URL, can download the file until that exact second, and after that the URL is expired, it's not good anymore. So this is spectacular if you want to share information with customers, but you don't want to give them permanent access, you don't want to give them a username password to your entire bucket. You just say, here, get this file, here's the link, it's good for a day, knock yourself out. If you don't get it, your link is no good anymore, you've got to call me back for a new link. So very, very, very cool stuff. Now the gentleman over there asked how much it cost, and then he left.
It's because you didn't tell him in time.
So he doesn't really care how much it costs. It costs 3 cents per gig for the first terabyte. These are all monthly prices. And if you want to use Glacier storage, so Glacier is meant really for backup. So stuff,
I'm using that.
Glacier, right? So if you're using Glacier, which is, it's not meant for you to upload and download and upload. It's really meant for you to upload and then forget about it because it's backups. It's a penny a gig up to the first terabyte, and then the price goes down from there. That's the most expensive price that you're going to pay. Each request, so put, get, whatever you're doing, it's half a cent per thousand requests, all right? And then transferring data in is free, and transferring data out is 12 cents a gig for the first terabyte, and the price goes down from there. So 12 cents is the most you'll ever pay. And so I do a little example here. Say you upload 100 gigs of stuff in your business, and every month your users download about, you know, 50 gigs of it plus or minus, and you have 250,000 requests, which is pretty, I mean, you have 250,000 requests to download files from your customers, 10 bucks a month. 10 bucks a month. So what's 10 bucks a month to put it in Amazon S3 versus how much it would cost to store the 100 gigs and handle the upload and download bandwidth and the support on your own HTTP servers or in your own corporate infrastructure versus 10 bucks a month. And you don't have to back up this stuff anymore, right? I mean, Amazon is fully redundant. We're trusting that they have backups and redundancy in their systems. So they have whatever nines of backup and redundancy. And when I showed you guys this pricing of 3 cents, if you can actually ask for low redundancy storage, so you don't need it to be 5 9 storage, you need it to be, I don't know, it's three nines or whatever storage. So if you need low redundancy storage, the price is even cheaper. So if you're just using it to share patches, and if it, you know, if something goes wrong, who cares, we'll just upload it again, you can pay less than this 3 cents a gig for uploading stuff that doesn't really need to be very highly redundant in the cloud. So this is, I would like to ask Roy to tell us what Progress's entire Amazon bill or Rackspace's bill is, but I bet you it's not a significant number for the services that they're providing out in the cloud. So it's insane how cheap it is. I can't stress it. My EC2 and S3 bills is rarely more than $5 or $10 a month. So I don't have anything to do with it. Exactly.
I mean, I run Arcade out of there, showroom images and stuff. We have, you know, dozen to 30 images running every month in the storage for it. And it's very reasonable.
It's insanely cheap. It's crazy. So the whole point of this presentation is to say to you, look, this is dirt cheap, free, stop doing it in-house. Same thing with my Amazon EC2. I tell people, you don't need to do all this stuff, but you have to do a proof of concept. You need to benchmark something. You need to migrate to Linux. Why are you paying for machines $10,000, $20,000? Do your proof of concepts in the cloud for $30, right? Don't put any sensitive corporate data in there, God forbid, but do your proof of concepts in the cloud for $30, $40. Erase it all when you're done, or take an image of it that's going to cost you $1 a month to retain the image, shut down your images, you did your proof of concept, and your boss will say, $30, knock yourself out. But if you tell him I need a $5,000 server to do my proof of concept, maybe he's got to ask for a little bit of authorization. And if he doesn't, please take my business card, because I would like to offer you my services.
But you just said, God forbid, with sensitive information there.
Yes. So the question is, well, it wasn't a question, it was a statement with a question embedded in it. God forbid you put sensitive information there. I am of the opinion, the personal opinion, that any information you put in the cloud is potentially public. Roy will tell you, and Roy says this in his slides, that when they fire up an Amazon EC2 machine, within seconds they're being attacked. How many attacks are you seeing on your machines?
Thousands a day.
So these machines...
But, you know, with a little bit of work, you can protect your machine.
Exactly.
And if you encrypt your data yourself, then it's not quite as wide open on the net as Paul likes to say, but I respect it. That's the way you should think about it.
Yes.
Anything on S3, anything here is potentially public information.
So I'm not saying that your information is open to the internet. I'm saying that if it's not stored behind your corporate firewall, then it's available to be attacked. Now, if it's encrypted up there and you've got the firewall set up in Amazon properly, I'm not saying the data is easily available, but the information is there. The second thing is, today the US government does not have to tell you if it's going to go grab information from your cloud services. They can go to the cloud provider with a subpoena, take the data, and use it against you without telling you. And in a lot of cases, the cloud provider is not allowed to tell you that the government came and took that information. So, I'm from Canada, so a lot of Canadian companies will not store data in Amazon S3 because they don't want their data in Canada. So they'll use a Canadian cloud provider who in writing guarantees that the data is physically stored in Canada. Same thing for Gmail. Gmail is taking over, you know, Google for enterprise. But a lot of Canadian companies won't use Google Apps for enterprise because their emails are being stored in the US, and so they'll take a local, a Canadian email service provider because they know their email is stored in Canada. So if there's a subpoena, it's much more difficult for an American court to go and grab data off of a Canadian server than off of an American server. So again, I'm not saying that it's woohoo, wide open, available, but it's there, it's susceptible to attack, it's susceptible to seizure much more easily than anything that you have behind your corporate firewall.
Right? Of course, there's, you know, what was the target, and that's behind the firewall.
Correct.
So I wonder how safe those places are.
I think, my opinion is that your, I use the example of your car, okay? You have a GM Cruze, a Volkswagen Jetta, or a Porsche 911. Your car is only as secure as the thief who does not want to steal that car. The thief that wants to steal your car will steal your car. If he needs a Volkswagen Jetta 2011, because that's what someone told him to steal, the first Volkswagen 11 2011 is gone in, I don't know how many seconds. So if someone comes to you and says, I want your data, it's his. It might take him a day, it might take him five, he's gonna get your data. There is no Cisco firewall or whatever that's gonna stop him. Target, Sony, all these guys are the perfect examples. So just keep that in mind. A very long-winded answer to your question, but keep that in mind when you store data in the cloud. So when we do, for example, proof of concepts, we'll obfuscate the data before creating the data sets in the cloud.
So to put your application database on the cloud, it's not secure then. Oh, is it less secure to have it in-house or the same level of security?
Loaded question. The question is,
it all depends on what you do in house.
Yeah.
If you're going to be sloppy in house, yeah, it could be more secure in the cloud. It could be better off in the cloud if you're going to be that sloppy.
I have a customer that has no firewall. There's a little, you know, Office Depot D-Link router with a firewall in it, you know, and there's a bizarro port number that reroutes to his Linux box. So I tell that into the router address, and I go right in and I know the root password. So his data is less secure than anything you put in the cloud.
Well, that's extreme. Everybody, you know, like the NSA is hacked into the Cisco routers.
They own the Cisco router. When China now will not deploy Cisco and IBM, part of it of course is political with the stuff going on in Russia, but part of it is because of all these NSA hacks they think is built into that technology. So there is no answer to your question, unfortunately. It's like the gentleman said, it all depends on how secure you are in-house versus how secure you are on the
potentially,
cloud.
Theoretically, can you be as secure in-house or on the cloud as in-house?
I don't even know how to. Theoretically, can you be as secure in the cloud as you can be?
Probably, if you do enough encryption levels, okay, and are doing it yourself, probably.
Yes, but again, my opinion is always, if somebody wants your data, whether it's in-house or on the cloud, it's theirs. It's just a matter of...
The only way to have a safe system is to put your computer in a safe, unplug no internet,
yeah,
right? And then you gotta go through a biometric to get in, and someone can still get through.
So I saw that on Mission Impossible.
Yeah,
what's the other one I like?
That's not how to keep your data safe, that's how to make your eyes, like... you know, unsecured.
I'm gonna actually feel, I was worried that I was gonna be short on that. So let me tell you guys how you can actually use S3 in your applications in your everyday world. Now, for some reason, Amazon did not write an SDK for OpenEdge, and I blame Roy for that, because it's Roy's job to be lobbying these cloud companies to create SDKs for OpenEdge. However, there are SDKs for PHP and .NET, Java, JavaScript, Python. Most of these, the common known languages, more guys are coming in. It's great. Come sit down, please. There's already SDKs existing where you can, so you don't have to actually write a thousands of lines of codes, whatever, to integrate with Amazon S3. And for us in the OpenEdge world, someone did the heavy lifting for us, and it's free, and it's called S3 Command. So someone wrote in Python, they took the Python SDK, they wrapped it with a Python script called S3 Command, and you can use S3 Command from Windows or from Linux or anywhere that you can run Python, and you can do all of these things through the command line tool called S3 Command, which I did mention was free. All right? And very, very easy. Again, Python is available for, I haven't seen any platform where Python is not available. Maybe AS400, there's no Python, but I don't know. So, and it probably supports all, if at least most, of the common S3 SDK command functionality. All right, and when you do the help, you get back 256 lines of of help code with options and commands and whatever you can do with it. All right? So what do? Install Python, install S3 command. Now, if you're on Windows, you should write a little batch file so that you don't have to type Python space S3 command space all of your parameters. So you can write this little batch file here. On Linux, well, because the first line of the script says, you know, user bin Python, you don't have to do it. You can just run the script directly and it'll pick the correct interpreter like it does for KSH or Bash or any of the other Perl or whatever. So in Linux, just run S3 command. On Windows, create a little S3 command.bat just to hide the little bit of, God forbid, complexity here. All right? So very, very easy to do. If you don't want to remember usernames and passwords, or you don't want to provide username and passwords, that all the access keys and stuff on the command line, you can run S3 command minus configure, and it'll ask you, what's the access key? What's the this? What's the that? Are you using PGP encryption? What's your PGP encryption key? Blah, blah, blah. So you can do all of that, and then it'll store all that information in a little config file in your home directory, and then every time you run S3 command, he'll go and read that file. The secret access key will be in the file. Of course, there's that security concern of having the key in the file, but you can do that also, so that at least it's always in there. You don't have to always provide the keys and the passwords and whatnot. And of course, if you want to override the default, you can provide the username and password on the command line to use a different username and password if you want to. But this is an easy way to set it up so that you don't have to always provide the usernames and passwords, right? Now, how do I put this into OpenEdge ABL? OS command silent S3 command. That's it. You just integrated it into your ABL application. All right? Now, be careful. OS command silent does not return you the return code of the S3 command, because OS command silent launches a shell, whether it's cmd.exe or bash or whatever, and in the shell it runs the command. And the return code that's passed back to progress is the return code of the execution of the shell, which is always successful. So do not trust the return code of OS command. So you need to either somehow echo the command or something and grab the return code if you want to deal with the return code of S3 command. But it's not the return code of any command, and I've seen this in code all over the place where they look at OS error, but it's not the error of the command, it's the error of the shell.
I typically, when I have that problem, I use input through.
Input through, perfect.
Input through, and the command does whatever it is, and then I read the output command from that.
What I do is I do input through, and at the end of my scripts, I put return in capital letters, return code equals a number, and then as I'm looping through my input through, when I hit that string return code equals, I know that's my actual return code that my script finished, and then I can act on the return code. So yeah, definitely a great idea from Tom. Use input through to grab the return code and to grab any output if you want to show it on the screen or somehow act on the output. So a couple of examples now. We have until 9:30, right? So I have a few more correctly. Make a bucket, S3 command MB, or use CloudBerry Explorer if they're one-offs, you can just go into CloudBerry Explorer, click new bucket, but S3 command MB. Now, remember that bucket names are shared across all of the S3 space. So that bucket name is not unique to you, it's bucketname.s3.amazonaws.com. So do not be surprised if dustin.s3.amazonaws.com has already been taken by one of the numerous other Dustins in the United States. Too bad, so sad. It's gone. It's gone forever. So be aware of that, that it's across, it's a DNS name, right? So it's across all of the space. So name your buckets accordingly. And don't be surprised if, you know, dog, cat, and home are already taken. Surprisingly, though, pugchallenge.amazon is mine now because it wasn't taken. So maybe I'll sell it to the guys later. I'll put all kinds of terrible things on there. Oh, the official pug challenge bucket. List your buckets, ls. Everybody knows the ls command, I hope, unless you're a Windows guy. But just do ls, s3 command ls, and there is my bucket. This is the standard S3 notation. So just like you know HTTP:// it's S3:// bucket name and then the rest of the directory path afterwards. All right? You want to upload a file? S3 command put. Where do I want to put it? I want to put it in S3:// pug challenge 1. If there were more directories, I could list the directories. If I wanted to name the file something different, just like any other copy command that you know already, very simple. You can do an ls of the file. So there it is, there's the size. Here's the full path to the file, all right? You want to download? Well, the command is get. So we follow, you know, the HTTP conventions, put and get for a file. Very, very simple. So what about when I do it from a web browser? Well, if I put in pugchallenge1.srtotal.txt, the file that I uploaded, I'm going to get access denied, of course. You're not giving me an access key and a password. So what am I going to do? I'm going to sign a URL, and it expects an expiry second in epoch time. So epoch time is the number of seconds since January 1st, 1970. So there's a whole bunch of epoch, you know, dates to epoch converters. Just Google them. But you can get the current epoch time or write a little function to calculate the epoch time for a date. So, for example, you know, June 11th, 6 p.m. Eastern, that's the epoch time. So what did I do? I signed the URL, epoch time, and it generated this. Now, if any of you are brave enough to type this entire key into your browsers right now, it will work. You will download total.txt. It'll work until June 11th at 6 p.m. That's a very valid key right now to go and get that file. But once you hit June 11th, 6001, access denied, request has expired. And he'll tell you, here's the expiry time, and here's the server time. And you can see I missed it by 5 seconds. So you get these errors coming out to your system. So again, very, very cool way to share data without giving anyone a username and password, and only having that URL valid for a very limited amount of time. All right? You want to find out some information? Oh, it's a plain text file. Here's the size. Who owns it? The ACL, PQFALAS, who has full control of the file. All this information is available to you. Disk usage, so a lot of commands you're used to. You want to see how much space you're taking in each of the buckets. All right? What else quickly? Another cool one is synchronizing. So you can actually say, synchronize this local directory with that Amazon directory, or synchronize the Amazon directory with my local directory. So the direction you want to synchronize. It's not a two-way synchronization. So you can say, hey, here's my directory. I set it up. This is what's supposed to be in the cloud. Here, go and sync that up. So whatever's changed, he'll upload into the Amazon directory. And then same thing, you can sync down. You can do access logging, so who's uploading and downloading and whatnot. And another cool thing is you can upload large files in multiple parts. So all of you who have flaky internet connections in hotels and you have a multi-gig file to upload, well, you don't necessarily want to upload that in one chunk, and you get to 946 megs and it craps out. So you can tell with S3 command, load it in 100 chunks. So if any one chunk fails, you can just restart that chunk as opposed to having to restart the entire file, which is very, very cool also. And the usual stuff, you can move and delete and copy stuff between your buckets. All right. So I hope this has you thinking. I'm going to take some questions, and then depending on time, I could just tell you a little bit about the project I did for a customer, which is a really, really cool project, a very, very good use case of Amazon S3. So questions? We're good?
Let's hear about the project.
Yeah. Steph?
Because there is an existing SDK for probabilities.net.
Yeah.
You probably can use the SDK through OpenSSL.net.
Yeah, so the...
Instead of using S3 command, so if somebody wants to do it in Windows and access the object and push files.
So the comment is that since there is an SDK for .NET, if you're developing OpenEdge for .NET applications, you can probably use the .NET objects directly in your .NET code rather than going through this command line interface. So yeah, definitely a great comment. So I'll tell you quickly about my project. It's time's up, it's 9:30, so please feel free to go. But I'll tell you quickly about the project. This is a customer that is a distributor of sports equipment throughout North America, and they have a catalog of probably about 250,000, 200,000 JPEGs of their product, and they have a huge database of product information. And all of their customers, which are the actual retailers, they're salivating to get access to all of these images and all this product information, and they don't want to have to manage that themselves because they're paying for the products, they're buying the products from the distributor. So the distributor said, hey, here's a way for us to make a few bucks, let's rent all this product information to our customers. So what we did was, for every customer that signed up for this image service, we watermarked the images with the customer number, so it's an invisible watermark, you can't see it, but the image is watermarked. We create the full set of 150, 200,000 images, depending which images they want. We upload all those images into the customer's private bucket in Amazon S3, and then the customer has access to download those images and all of the product information. There's inventory information, catalog, product information. We upload all of this stuff into Amazon S3. And then the other service we provided to the customer is, as these images, they're always being updated. There's always new images, new products. So the other thing we did for is that the customer can come in weekly, monthly, whatever he wants, and say, hey, give me everything that's changed since the last time I signed up, or give me everything that's changed in the last X days. So all of this, we did all of this in PHP. We basically did our own PHP REST web service written directly in PHP. And they just come in and they grab these images. So now the customer doesn't have to host terabytes of images, because really there's a full image set for every customer because they're all watermarked uniquely for that customer. He doesn't have to go and host all of this and serve all of this through his corporate network. We just upload it one time, so he pays for the one-time upload charge. Well, actually the upload charge is free. It's the download charges that he pays for. And all of that is hosted in Amazon, and through the signed URL, we don't have to give the customer a username or password. Every time he runs the function, hey, give me everything that's changed, I actually generate a JSON array that has all the signed URLs for all the images, and he goes and he downloads all the information, all the images that have changed, or he downloads the inventory or the catalog or whatever product information. So this is a perfect use case for a customer who's got terabytes of data to share, wants to share it in a controlled fashion, doesn't want to share it through their own environment. Any other questions? Yeah?
Yeah, and how do you create the signed URL?
The command was just here previously.
Okay.
Where you just say S3 command, sign URL, here it is.
Okay.
You just say sign URL. Any other questions? So come and see me afterwards. Thank you very much.